So we have some time for questions. Carl has the microphone, so. Lady right there. And hold the microphone horizontal if you could.
I have a question.
Hello, is it on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a question for Joe McNamara. It has to do with federal funding of local police. And the question is, do most local police forces get a certain percentage of federal funding for their narcotics enforcement, and how does that influence their policies towards drug enforcement in general in their communities?
The federal government is rather generous for enforcement and, in fact, demanding of local police. And also in seizure property, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars, and the federal government loves to distribute checks to local law enforcement people in civil seizure cases where there is no presumption of innocence. And the saying in police work is the police have become addicted to seizure money. When I was chief in San Jose, my city manager sent over a proposed budget with $0 for equipment. So I politely went over and I said, you know, it's traditional when you have a police force that you buy police cars and guns and equipment for the cops. And he laughed and he said, you guys seized $4 million last year, and I expect you to do better this year, and it will be involved in your job assessment. And so that's the corruption that has really sunk into this whole enforcement process. The federal government, part of that, one of my colleagues said $30 billion a year of federal money. A lot of it does go to local law enforcement, and there's a lot of hidden money in law enforcement training programs where the top brass is transported twice a year to nice resorts, and the DEA always gives a presentation, and they always pick up the tab, and the presentation is always the same. Here's the good news. We stopped opium production in parts of Afghanistan. We disrupted some cocaine production in Colombia. Here's the bad news, that the major opium production is now coming from the liberated part of Afghanistan where allies are, and the bad news is the other Andean countries have picked up the production that was curtailed somewhat in Colombia. So it just goes on and on. I think, as Ethan says, there's no measurement here of any progress. It's a jihad. It's a holy war. It's one that they feel you have to fight. It doesn't matter whether you win or not. You just must make the fight. But the power of the federal government over local law enforcement during the years that I have watched, I can't believe. We were always drilled into us that a national police force meant the end of liberty in our country. But policing really has become more and more under national control, and the threat of terrorism is just increasing that tremendously, and local governments are hurting for cash, so they turn to Washington as everyone else does, and that when you take the Yankee dollar, you sing the Yankee song, and that's what's happening with local law enforcement.
Wait, we have the microphone.
I wanted to ask Jeff if you would put a age limit on access, and how would you enforce that?
I didn't talk about any of these sort of I call in between issues. If you're going to do something besides out and out legalization, are there halfway houses? Are there partial measures such as sin taxes or age restrictions or advertising restrictions or things like that? Personally, I would not. The argument for age restrictions is that kids are not. At least some kids are not ready, mature enough, smart enough, thoughtful enough, or whatever, to use automobiles or alcohol or cigarettes or drugs. Okay, that's undoubtedly true. But I think all of our evidence suggests that the age restrictions are ignored a lot more than they're obeyed. And almost all the kids who really want to get the stuff get it. And so I think what the age restrictions mainly do is teach kids not to respect the law. And to some extent, I think the age restrictions teach parents, or give parents a false sense of security that somehow the law is taking care of this problem, so they don't have to worry about it themselves. So I think that since it's a matter of practice, kids are going to get it with or without the age restrictions. It would be better to just be upfront and honest and clear and say, yeah, it's something that parents have to deal with. If kids get messed up, it's something that the parents and the kids are going to have to handle.
It's a question of whether the government sets the age restrictions or the parents or the school or other institutions.
Yeah, this is a question for this is a question for either Jeff or Ethan. And it's really this. Will people be responsible for the consequences of their actions, irrespective of whether they're on drugs or not? In other words, Mill's point, the English philosopher's point, was that people are responsible for the consequences of their actions. In other words, it's no defense to say that I was under the influence of alcohol or of drugs, and that's why I ran over this person, or that's why I killed this person. Are you prepared to go that route?
That's certainly exactly the route that I would go. I'm not going to assert that everyone will act responsibly, and I'm not going to deny that some people will attempt to avoid the consequence of their actions by trying to blame it on some substance that they consumed or whatever.
Well, it has
but
been a traditional
prohibition
defense,
doesn't
has
prohibition
been.
Doesn't prevent that. So I think that's a given, and indeed I think to some extent prohibition promotes not taking responsibility, because promotion creates drugs as these demons, as these all-powerful things that are so horrible that we have to prohibit them. It gives them far more power than they actually have, whereas if they were legal, there would be a little bit more tendency to say, look, you made the choice to consume it, okay, now bear the consequence.
I feel obliged to make a statement rather than a question. I spent 3 years, if you will believe it, as president of the League of Women Voters up in El Dorado County. They let men in too. We spent two of those years doing a study on the effects of drugs in our county. I found several things. One of the things, we interviewed people from police to nurses. A comment by a nurse at a school that registered heavily with me is, prohibition doesn't stop kids. It actually, the excitement of doing something that's against the law will cause some of them to use the drugs they wouldn't otherwise try. Incidentally, the result of that 2 years study, our league, which we can't speak of now because it's not a national policy, so we can't, agreed that marijuana should be treated the same as alcohol, and that other drugs on schedules 2 and 3 should be treated the same as those drugs on schedules 3, 4, and 5, available by prescription and monitored by the Food and Drug Administration. Now, this is not ordinarily a very radical organization, and it took a lot. There was a lot of blood on the floor. The biggest problem was getting anybody to do the study.
Yeah, well, that's what Ethan.
Ethan is familiar with the book Drug War Facts that you put out and so forth. I found it too big. I found problems getting somebody to read the facts. And I have another organization to which I belong has put out a little book which I have with me, about 17-page hand pocket size like this. And if you could get something out like this with just the facts, ma'am, just the facts.
Okay, thank you.
You'll get more people to read it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And there is another issue that I think you've ignored. I'm sorry. And it's Catherine Austin Fitz, the former Assistant Secretary of Housing under Bush 1, has an article on the web called Myth of the Rule of Law. You can all go to it and pull it up, and I recommend everybody read it. Just point your search engine to the Myth of the Rule of Law. The reason drugs have to be illegal from a federal government point of view is the money that is generated and is needed by our economy. George Soros, in an interview with Michael Rupert pre-Enron, estimated that 50% of the value of our economy was sustained by illegal activities. Those two activities he mentioned were the kiting of corporate profits in order to inflate stock market values and the laundering of drug money, because drug money is cheap money, and cheap money gives those who have it a competitive advantage against those who don't. And I think unless we recognize that fact and make the people realize that's the reason the federal government dumps on medical marijuana, because they can't afford the leak in the dike.
Right. Okay. We have other people have some questions too. Thank you. How about the gentleman right here in green?
So the war on drugs has brought a lot of power to the federal government, and it would seem that the power is perhaps the most addictive drug of all. Do we think that we can actually, you know, get the federal government to back off, or are they going to keep, you know, trying to just, instead of acting rationally or reasonably, simply push their policies through by force of will?
Who wants to address that?
Well, I mean, it's a process of working at the local level first, changing state policies, and then sending the message up nationally. I'll tell you something very interesting happened last summer. There was an amendment introduced in the House of Representatives, co-sponsored by a liberal New York Democrat named Maurice Hinchey and Dana Rohrabacher, the Republican from Southern California. And what it would have done would have been to prohibit the Justice Department from spending a penny to go after the medical marijuana outlets in California and the other states that had legalized marijuana for medical purposes. And before, you know, we would have been lucky to get, you know, 30, 40 votes from Democrats and maybe 3 or 4 from Republicans. But this time, you know, a number of things had happened. One was that we now won initiatives, you know, in a number of states representing like something 35% to 40% of the entire population. The second thing that happened was the public opinion polls were showing 70% to 80% supporting medical marijuana. The third thing that happened was that, you know, I'm now in a position where I can access the Democratic leadership of the House of Representatives, not directly, but that there are people on my board or friends or funders or supporters who, when they call, you know, Pelosi or Gephardt or Nita Lowey or Rosa DeLauro, the minority whip and the head of the, you know, their calls get taken. And these people want to make those calls. And the result was that 70% of all the voting Democrats voted in favor of this amendment, and a dozen Republicans voted in favor of it, and many more said that if it had been a vote of conscience, they would have done it. Now, this is going to come back around again. So I think it's just a matter of time. But now, mind you, it really depends also. It's about political organization. You know, I mean, the NRA is powerful because it's not just because there's a lot of people who feel strongly about the issue, but because it's an organization that actually is able to bring that stuff form, you know, to focus in the way of a political fist. And that's what has to happen.
Your question actually relates also to the purpose of independent, because the mission of what we're involved in is to bridge the gap between the problems that people are facing and perhaps the mythology or misguided notions that people believe is the case with policy. How about the gentleman right here?
Thanks. One of the things that's surprising to learn about today's prohibition, or about alcohol prohibition, is that it did not criminalize possession or use. My question, and it kind of overlaps each of your areas, is how has today's prohibition that does criminalize possession and use, how different is that than the alcohol prohibition model, and how has that impacted our society compared to alcohol prohibition?
I think it's a little misleading to say, although technically accurate, to say that alcohol prohibition didn't criminalize possession and use. It's true that the federal constitutional prohibition did not, and the Volstead Act, which implemented it, did not. But the state laws in many states basically treated possession of small amounts as intent to distribute, intent to sell, intent. So they sort of got around the language to a great degree if they wanted to. So the critical question was, were the authorities, state or federal, attempting to enforce those laws vigorously? There was a lot of heterogeneity across states, and I think on average the degree of attempt to enforce alcohol prohibition was less than what we currently have with drug prohibition now. But to me, that emphasizes the point that it's not whether you criminalize use, the supply side or demand side. If you do either side, it's basically the same as doing both, and that's why I think the decriminalization approach is misguided. It's at a minimum bizarre to say it's legal to buy it but not to sell it, okay? And you're going to have the same effects if you vigorously try to enforce a prohibition against the supply side, against the trafficking, whether or not you legalize the demand side.
Two last questions. How about the lady right in the back there?
I'll be the lady. Thank you very much. My name's Rebecca Kaplan, and I live in Oakland, and I'm a local elected official, and I'm also helping out with the Oakland Cannabis Initiative. And there have been some amazingly hopeful things happening, and one of them is the confluence of different interests that all lead to the same conclusion. And I think that it's much easier to start with cannabis and get people on board, because the visceral fear that people have when you say heroin or cocaine, they don't have, at least here we know, around cannabis, and the latest national polls show a majority agreeing that cannabis is less dangerous than alcohol. So that's a very hopeful sign for people accepting that it should be modeled similar to alcohol if it's not any more dangerous. And one of the things...
Do you have a question?
Yes. Well, my question was in terms of the coalition building aspect, that there's a lot of people whose prime concern is around ending the growth of prisons. And in California right now, with the prisons having just declared a state of emergency, there's a lot of people who don't care about cannabis one way or the other, but they sure care about dealing with the burgeoning prison crisis. And so I'd be curious if anybody has anything to add on that. We've found in Oakland some people who have ready to start the initiative.
I think,
thank you.
You know, I think one of the ironies of that is we may change policy for the wrong reasons. If you take a look at the terrible destruction of lives that we've become callous to as a society, and it relates back to the last question, too, that we've allowed the dehumanization of people using certain substances, but if they use Prozac or they use some other mind-altering substances, we don't view them the same as someone using cocaine or heroin or marijuana. And there's an actual growing hatred, it seems to me, on the part of many of your colleagues in Congress and in state legislatures that are fanatical. They don't want to even just jail people. They want to deprive them of their driver's licenses, of their college aid. How many lives are we ruining? I think Ethan mentioned all the prominent politicians who now fess up to using marijuana. But if they had been busted under today's draconian laws, they wouldn't have had successful careers. And that's another cost that's never figured out. So I think as much as I have worked with Ethan for 15 years, that we shouldn't forget that for the first 140 years of this republic, your right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness included the right to use any substance that you wanted and to sell it. Bear aspirin sold heroin tablets for children that you could buy, and you could buy other drugs in the store, and it related back to the Declaration of Independence that this was our right inherent that we were born with. It's not federal government or any government's right to dole out certain rights to us. We own those rights, and we should insist that they not take them away, quote, for our own benefit. And I think if we stick with that principle and bring out the prison situation, bring out the police corruption, bring out the judicial corruption, bring out the routine violation and erosion of civil rights that we all held dear, that you come back to one essential conclusion, that the criminal law should never be used against chemical substances. It has no no logic of being there, and the policy in 1914 was changed by the action of fanatical religious groups who inserted their version of sin into the penal code. And that's what we're paying for. The stereotypes of drug users that they created a century ago are so strong, as the users are immoral, evil people, that we can't have a rational debate on this. There's no reason that we shouldn't. In fact, there are a lot of reasons that we should, because of the damage that the government policies are doing. And I think that's the principle that we should never lose sight of. It's not up to the government to tell us what rights they're going to dole out to us. We were born with those rights.
One thing I might mention about the question about prisons, we have a new book also called Changing the Guard, which relates to this in part. And of course, the obvious truth that all the panelists have referred to is the huge incarceration of people because of the criminalization of use and so forth of these drugs has converted the prisons into warehouses for people who have committed non-invasive acts in most cases. How about the gentleman right here? And that'll be our last question.
I wonder if there are other countries that have viewed drug use perhaps in a more enlightened way that we might use as models. I'm thinking specifically about, for instance, the death penalty code that a lot of other countries now are against. And I wonder, is the same thought processes going on in other countries concerning drug use in terms of liberalizing it that we might use as a model?
I mean, the answer is yes. You especially see it in Western Europe. You see it in Australia, Canada, to some extent the Caribbean, Latin America. Essentially in a few areas. When it comes to cannabis, which is marijuana and hash, you basically see a movement towards decriminalization and sort of a de facto backing in to regulation. You know, the coffee shop system in the Netherlands is not just, you know, one or two in Amsterdam, it's the entire country. And the Swiss recently looked like they were going to leapfrog the Dutch and actually do a full legalization model. They called it licensing. But, you know, last year the British moved towards decriminalization. The Canadians are heading that way. The Jamaicans just had a commission that moved that way. The second area is on the broader area of harm reduction, basically accepting that reducing the harms of drugs rather than trying to reduce drug use per se was what's pivotal. That meant they moved forward with needle exchange and HIV prevention programs 20 years ago and with much better consequences than America's had. It also means that they've made methadone available not just through clinics, which can be hard to reach, but really over through doctors' offices and pharmacies, making it widely available. They've also begun to prescribe pharmaceutical heroin to drug addicts in Switzerland, Germany, Netherlands, Spain, and shortly Canada will do the same thing. So you really do see a much more pragmatic policy moving forward in all these areas. I think the most encouraging stuff has been in Canada, which was in a place where we are now is where Canada was 10 years ago. And they have moved very rapidly. I mean, they are moving far towards decriminalization and maybe ultimately towards legalization of cannabis. They're going to set up this heroin prescription trial later on this year. You know, we're not... Sometimes I analogize this stuff historically. You know, you look at America in the 1850s and early 60s when we were almost the only country left in the West except for Spain and Portugal that still had slavery. You know, we kind of fell behind everybody else. And I think in our punitive drug prohibitionist system, we're doing the same thing. Mostly because it's not something so straightforward as an 18th Amendment that can be repealed. We would like to. It's an easier phrase, but there's not the thing that's clearly to be repealed.
I want to thank our three speakers and... I also want to thank all of you for joining with us to make this evening so successful. Again, there are copies of Drug War Crimes upstairs, and I'm sure that Jeff would be delighted to autograph copies. For those of you who are petitioners, I'm going to have to ask you to do it outside the room, though. But we look forward to you joining with us at future events. Thank you so much, and good night.